Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome the birthday boy, Michel Gondry. So what do you think of when you watch these videos? Do you think of how hard they might have been to make?
No, actually, I was thinking that it looked all right. I was pleased with myself. They're pretty old. I mean, the Björk video, it's 15 years old. The Rolling Stone is 13 years old. Yeah. So they're not too bad for this time, I think.
No, they hold up very well.
That's a good thing. In a way, they were not so exposed. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the chance to get hit song to make as videos, but I realized later that it was sort of a blessing because they were still not too exposed when I put them in my DVD, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it's good because if I had done like a video that was a big hit as a song, then it's sort of washed by the time.
Well, you had practice making videos for your band, Wee Wee. Could you mm-hmm. talk about that? At first, how you got into that band as a drummer? Could you talk about that?
Well, we were in art school, like a lot of musicians actually start their band in art school. It's not very original. But I met my friend for life in a way when we were 16 and we moved into this sort of art school for sort of bad student that could draw, and we started a band in maybe 81, 82, that lasted 10 years and it was called Wee Wee, and I had done some experimentation with animation in an earlier age. And then one day I bought a film camera. I mean, I was flatmate with my friend Jean-Louis Bonpoint, who is my DP now. And he had some equipment and he was a director, so he helped me a little bit. So that's how it started. I mean, I was doing little animated piece of 2 minutes that was fitting our music because it was quite minimalist and short, mm-hmm. the song were. So it was easy to illustrate. And the good thing about that is I would never be allowed to impose upon them any personal vision I have to share with their idea because they were coming, especially Etienne, the leader of the band, was coming from the visual world as well, so he had as many ideas as me. So it taught me to collaborate with artists and be able to take in what they have to bring and what they have in mind and just not ignore it.
Mm-hmm. And Björk knew these videos. Wasn't these videos that drew?
Yeah, she saw one. I had done 6 with my band, and 3 were like ultra minimalist, and 3 were a little less minimalistic. And she saw actually the last one we did. It's called La Ville, and she liked it. And then she went to see me in Paris, and she saw all the other videos of Wee Wee that were not in my showreel, because I guess people thought it would be not good for me to show them. But she was the first one to really respond to this early work I had done, and she couldn't stop laughing, which was very rewarding. I think we have a very similar sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes when we're having dinner, I make like a completely flat joke, and I hear a big laughter, and it's Björk. She's a good audience for me. She always thinks I should be a stand-up comedian or something.
Could you talk about the collaboration on Human Behavior, the video that we saw with her?
Well, she went to visit me in France and in Paris. And the good thing with Björk is we were at sort of the same level. I mean, she was pretty successful with her band, and she was moving into being a solo artist. And me, that was sort of my beginning as well. So we were sort of equal. But the good thing with her, she would never, up to now, we never put people in competition. Because she's very aware of that. She thinks that if you select people by putting them in competition, you put them at the lowest of their confidence. So it's really a bad way. You're going to screen the people who are the most maybe charismatic or the more aggressive. But it doesn't mean that's going to be the best project. So she has an instinct to pick people for the right people for the right project, at least for what she needs. So that's one thing that's great with her, and I've always been like that. And as well, as I was saying, like I was working with Bimebound, she would throw a lot of ideas. I would throw a lot of ideas, and we had the conversation that went very fast and very animated, where she talked about the Night of the Hunter, we talked about cartoon we liked, like the Eastern European animation versus Walt Disney, and the more craft and handmade, and a lot of things that we grew up she's like 3 years younger than me, but we in Iceland they would see probably more similar program like France and America, so we are very much into this type of TV shows in France in the 60s and early 70s, where a lot of coming from the Poland or Czechoslovakia, and you had this quality of handmade that you would not see from the Walt Disney Studio, for instance.
But they were handmade live-action animations, stop-motion?
Well, stop-motion and with puppets. And I mean, there is this film that's great by Yuri Nerstein that's called Hedgehog in the Fog. I mean, it was more actually the 80s. He works with texture, and he has this system he made put together. It's like a multi-plan, and it's very layered. But anyway, basically, when you see the film, it doesn't hide how it's made. It invites you to understand how it's made, and to at least for me or people like me, it stimulates you to want to do the same, because it's not something like that. It's in your face and it's very sleek, mm-hmm. Impenetrable, like perfect. So I always like that this idea that this creation you see includes sort of the making of within the frame. And I remember in 81 or 80, I went to see The Cure in concert. At the time there were three, and the concert, the music was so simple and great that it would stimulate you emotionally. It was very strong, but as well you would come back home and say, okay, I'm going to do my band. And I think, I mean, of course, the Sex Pistols and those guys, that was their strength. It's like they, everybody started a band when they saw them, because it seemed so simple. And I think that's something I always thought of when I continue working, even if the technique is pushing boundaries or try to be complex, there is a sort of a simplicity that says, oh, well, you see how it's made and you could do it yourself.
Yeah. And were you responding in a way against what you were seeing on, say, MTV or the conventional music videos, which are much more, I guess, elaborately produced, more slick in a way?
Well, that's something that sometimes it bugs me, because people who are not really part of the video world, they say I'm an MTV generation, I'm coming from MTV, but I mean, my video were hardly seen on MTV, and many times I've seen, even in recent years, 100 best video of all time, and I had zero in them. So, and it's fine, but then after, if people say, oh yeah, that's MTV generation, and they include me, I find something that's unfair. But at least if I was from the MTV generation, I should be represented on MTV, which I never was.
So you're really drawing on different traditions, early animation, early film?
Well, I don't know if I was trying early animation. I was trying, to be unconventional. I was just, I bought this camera, a Bolex 16mm camera, and I tried to explore every possibility with this camera. And I think it's how I define a little bit my style. I would rather make things myself than to have to ask people and to ask to fill up a form to ask for subvention, which I did once, and it didn't work out. So I decided, okay, I will do the stuff I want to do on my own. So I define a little bit my style by knowing my limitation and then trying to work within this parameter.
And did you always make things with your hands? I mean, that's the quality that sort of carries through all your work. This incredible.
I made stuff with my nose, actually. I made the before Rubik's Cube with my nose once. No, okay, sorry. That's okay. Sorry, I have a Tourette syndrome about bad jokes, and it comes out. And I apologize. I'm
going to make bad jokes. We're here for your bad jokes.
We wanted to do with my girlfriend a toilet paper roll where on every sheet I would write. We would write one of my bad jokes. So it's something to save paper, because you would not tear 2-3 feet of paper to one wipe. You just have one sheet because you want to read it.
But yourself.
Anyway, that's with itself. It's another bad joke, but this was true.
But your video with solving the Rubik's Cube with your nose has been seen by
2 million people.
2 million people. So.
So yeah, that's a paradox of YouTube. You think it's like something very democratic, but it's a big ego booster, because you do something completely stupid, and then you see how it exposed. So. But yeah, I like the things that are made by hand for the reason I said before. I think it's good that you can make the thing yourself first, and then later on you need a crew when you do a feature film, because unless you're going to spend 10 years, which would be very great. But it's difficult to frame that in a conventional production. Because when you have something that's a little awkward, generally people will oppose resistance to it, because it's not the way things are supposed to be done. So if you've done it before yourself, you say, well, you can do it this way, or you can do it this way, and don't tell me it's not possible. So that gives you this sort of strength. And there is this, especially when I started, and the crew on my shooting were very... sort of reluctant and not believing, and they, you know, they, you got people who are double of your age, and they've been shooting for 20 years, and then you come and you have something that seems silly to them, and they sort of mock you, like this guy. The first shooting I did, I was 26 year old, and I asked this grip, or the guy who pushed the dolly, that's a grip, I guess, to move the dolly from the window and turn around the bed and then frame a close-up of the clock. And it was quite specific because I needed that for my video. And I walk away from him and I turned back to him to ask him to give him more specificity. And he was like doing that in my back. And he was like 40 years old and I was 26 and I didn't know. I mean, it would be now I would have maybe fired him just for the... just to enjoy the action. But at the time, I was shy, and I said, oh, I can't... I was embarrassed that this guy was so trying to... So that would tell you how what you have to deal with when you are a young director and you have to work with this very crew who are a little fed up with everything. So to come back to the idea of doing stuff yourself, that's good, because at some point you're going to prove to this guy that it's possible, and they're going to think, oh yeah, this is not too as stupid as I thought, or stuff like that. And it's like I have my friend Jean-Michel Bernard, who composed my score. He's an excellent piano player and he's like super virtuoso. So when he has a big orchestra to direct, he's going to sit at the piano and play a little piece which like immediately shows that he knows what he's talking about. So everybody, a little bit of virtuosity is not too bad to convey or convince people that they are in good hands.
So working with the Rolling Stones, because they were extremely well established when they came to you to ask you to do that video.
Very established for 40 years.
Yeah. So what was that like? And where did you get the inspiration? The style, such an amazing looking video, but it seems to really be responding to the song and this idea of capturing what it's like to be on drugs, for one thing. I mean, it's sort of drug trip.
Yeah, I mean, it is, to be honest, it's a type of video. It's not my style, but I mean, like the morphing and the technique and the look, this is really me. But the idea to cut from the band to a sort of a parallel story, it's something that I tried to fight when I started to video, but The Rolling Stones, they wanted a certain way. They wanted to have the pretty girl. They wanted to have the performance, the Paris story. And I have to say I compromised because I wanted to do their video. And so this way it's put together, it's not exactly on the drug stuff. That it's funny because some people ask me if I was doing drug when they saw that. I mean, I'm sure if I was doing drug, I would do something more conventional, I guess, because it's kind of slow your brain, you know.
Right.
That I'm trying to convince my son of that, but it doesn't really listen for that. But anyway, the morphing was very in fashion at the time, and it had started a few years before with, for instance, this video by Michael Jackson when he would transform his face into all other faces, and that was the main reason to use morphing, to do something, becoming something else. And I had this idea to do to morph a picture with the same picture like half a second later. So we took this still camera and we took picture like 4 frames per second, something like that. And then we tried to just morph. I sent them to a beef company in Paris, and I asked them to just try to morph the picture one to the next one, and you get this gooey effect where they follow the arm, for instance. So as they don't separate the layer, the background going to stick to the hand, and it gives this effect. Because I was asking a guy who had done acid how it looked, and he told me it looks like the wall are like the surface of the tea when it gets cold. So it was very specific, and I sort of thought of that on this idea of the surface getting a little like little skin. And then it was the other effect that was stopping the time, and the idea was to shoot from two different angles at once with two cameras shooting at the same time, and then morphing from one to the other. That became this effect. And as you said, it was used for the Matrix, but it was another guy as well who claimed that, and he actually hates me. Quite funny to mention that because he had the idea to do 100 cameras, which I had to, but I couldn't do it, and he did it, and then I did that, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's how it goes. So I can't say I invented the effect for the Matrix. I participated.
What did you find in the process of animating with Legos that was... I mean, how difficult was that process? Because it strikes me as you might have come up with this idea that seemed really simple, but what was the...
No, well, like every simple thing, it's very complicated in reality. Well, the main difficulty, if you think of animating Lego, it's not like plasticine or moving paper when you have a shape and then you alter the shape and you take another picture. It's something you have to undo from scratch. So when the thing is two pieces, you have no reference of what was there before. So therefore, we had to have a guide on paper. So we shoot everything on video, and I wanted to make a video that was conventional, because I knew that with the layer of Legos, you had to recognize the shape very easily, otherwise you would not get anything. So I shot the most conventional video possible with performance on something for the street that obviously with shape and color that would allow the Lego to be represented by Lego. And then we pixelized it with a very simple program. Actually, my dad and my brother worked on it, and basically, they pixelized it in a similar shape than the Lego blocks. We printed every image on a piece of paper, and then the animator took every sheet of paper and built a sort of wall of Lego following exactly the shape. And then after, they put it in front of a 16mm camera and shoot it. But it sounds like a lot of work, which it is, but I mean, we worked like, 3 weeks with maybe 10 people. Which is interesting to me is like you have to come up with a system how to organize the work. I mean, if you do a classical animation, there is a lot of rules that you're going to follow, and it's all sort of calibrated, and there is a protocol you follow, and then you get to the result. But when you start something that's not been done, you have to create the protocol of how you're going to organize the work, and how you're going to make sure everybody understands it and does the same construction, etc. And that's really fun for me to work, to find this system that everybody can follow and produce the result.
Your work has often been noted for having a kind of childlike quality, and you've suggested that your childhood is important because you called your autobiographical film I've Been 12 Forever. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you about that, about what your childhood was like and how you think it affected your work.
Well, okay, but so it's really sound like a statement, this title, but I mean, I can just explain how it came. And of course, if I chose it, I made a statement from it, but it was not so, I was not like, I mean, it's not so important. In fact, I had a girlfriend at the time, and she told me one day, because she would ask me, oh, what age, when did you do that? And I always said when I was 12, because for some reason it's when you move to the next school, and it was a World Cup of football, and some event in my life that made me more remember this age than another. So every time she would ask me, I say, oh, I must have been 12. So she said, oh, you always said you were 12. So that it's how I got the title. But of course, it as well fits a little bit the style or whatever, the quality of the work. What I was referring to as well is there is a sense of when your brain is younger, of there is less connection and there is more, you absorb more. I mean, I have this very simplistic way of seeing the connection with the brain and the outside, which it's sort of blank in the beginning, and you have pre-connection or depending of what type of neurology or linguistic right. you believe, because it's a little blurry there. But basically, I always assume, or I sort of made my own theory that in the beginning, the information has a great importance, a great impact on you, because your brain is forming and you don't have a right. frame of reference. And as you grow older, everything that gets through your sense in your brain, you store smaller and smaller bits because you have already so much references and you just record the differences, for instance. I try to put myself at a stage where my eye or my senses were very angry of the outside world and much more absorbing. And it seems that I grow older, I see through a layer of glasses, which I don't wear glasses, but okay, that's another bad joke. But it seems that I see through a window or something. I'm aware of what's inside and what's outside. When you're a kid, it seems to be directly connected. I remember walking in the forest with my mom when I was maybe 4 years old or five, and I've been having this sort of acuity or sharpness of information that I don't have so far anymore. And it's a little bit like when you look at the eyes of people who get older, there is a little edge that goes that make it a little whiter. And I think it gets a little glaze that you add, and it's kind of a sad image. But going back to the youth, to me, is trying to connect with that and try to perpetuate that in the present time.
Often you give yourself very difficult technological challenges. I mean, many of your videos, you give yourself these very complex tasks to solve. Like, does that help you to somehow keep this quality you talk about? This challenge?
Yeah, maybe some. I mean, there is as well. There is a bit of show-off. I mean, I'm sure it's like people say, oh, how did you do that? Right. And I mean, I guess by getting a good response, I sort of like to hear that. And I know how to get that. In general, maybe it's as well a way to protect myself. Like Hitchcock would say, you run for cover, so you mean you do something you know. And sometimes I wish I could do something really simple, and the quality of it would burst out without any technology or any complexity. Unfortunately, every time I start something, it ends up to be complicated at some level. But I like the challenge. I like... Basically, when I do a video, I listen to the track, and I have a range of ideas, and there is this idea, and I think this is really ridiculous. And then I pass it, and then I come back and say, oh, wait a minute, maybe that's It'd be fun to do because it's stupid. Because I want to... If you have something that's so tenuous, it's like holding by a thread, then you think you're going to give yourself a lot of work to make it work. So like, okay, let's do a video all with Lego blocks. That sounds kind of pointless or vain or whatever. But then you come back to it and say, okay, you're going to have to work so hard to make it exist that it's going to become what's interesting about it. So I work a little bit like that, like taking the more tenuous idea and make it exist, and then I have to work double hard on that stimulating.
So let's talk about your transition into films, because your first film, Human Nature, is about a character who is, you know, literally grew up as a monkey and is like brought in to be kind of civilized. So let's set it up, I guess, to talk about how you got involved with this film with Charlie Kaufman, I mean, with Human Nature.
I was friends with Spike Jonze, and I had moved into Los Angeles in the hope of directing a movie. And I had worked on a screenplay on a project called The Green Hornet, which could have been great, but I don't think the studio liked what we came up with. And I kept reading screenplay and screenplay, and they were horrible. And one time, you know how you can find a screenplay? I mean, I asked my producer, my agent, to give me a screenplay of a movie I had liked. Well, let's say I read the screenplay for Taxi Driver, for instance. I'm not a big Scorsese fan, but I mean, I have to say this movie is amazing. So I wanted to check if like screenplay were boring by essence, and you have to make a good movie no matter what. But then I read it, and it was amazing on the paper. So it was kind of depressing to figure out that I got given bad material all this time. So I kept reading bad screenplay, and it was taking from me forever. And then Spike was working on Being John Malkovich, and he let me read the screenplay. And one more time, it was amazing, the reading. It was there. It was just like you could stop. Generally, it would take me 6 to 8 hours to read the screenplay. This one took me 2 hours. And I think for any English-speaking person, it would take 1 hour. And I just realized that this was you need the quality in the writing as well. So I met with Charlie Kaufman, and we had a lot of things we talk about in the way we conceive the geometry and storytelling. And like most of the video I had done, and I still do, it's a sort of a geometrical pattern. And when he tells a story, he's very much into this type of thinking. And so we got along very well, and later on, my friend Pierre Bismuth, who's a contemporary artist, give me this concept about memory erasing, and through Charlie Kaufman, it became Eternal Sunshine. So he was writing it, and it took forever. In the meantime, I read this spec screenplay that was Human Nature, and I asked him if I could do it.
When you make this move to directing feature films, you're working with actors in a way that, you know, is more maybe nuanced and different than working with musicians and singers. You have amazing performances by Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey. Could you talk a bit about Eternal Sunshine?
Well, the main thing into directing those actors is they were coming from such a different background that I have to put them in tune for the same tone for the film. And Charlie and I, we like Jim Carrey, and obviously we needed somebody solid to finance the film, and it's no secret that goes by the actor. And so we have Jim Carrey, and then we have Kate Winslet, who we found her amazing, especially in Smoking Singer by Jane Campion. She had some similarities in her unpredictability of mood swing, and that she was doing very wonderfully. And Jim Carrey, who is great too, because I kind of liked how he feels always sort of an outsider. But obviously, he puts a lot of physical energy, and he's very graphic, and he's very aware of the camera. So all sort of things that are different, because he comes from television or from more broad comedy. So I had to find a way to undertone him and push her to make them on the same level of acting or of size of acting. And Kate Winslet, when I met her, she said something really smart. She said to me, she was saying herself, she wanted to do the part, and I liked how she was really aggressively trying to get the part. And she said, I'm going to block Jim Carrey in a corner, and I will be Jim Carrey instead of Jim Carrey. And Jim Carrey would have to find something else, because you can't have two Jim Carrey, or there's a bad news. Well, anyway, okay. I will make it short now.
No, keep going.
People are losing interest. I made it too long. Okay, so anyway, she said I would be so big that he has to be small. And I think she made him as good as he was. I mean, I contributed to that and by many ways to trick him, because an actor like that come on the shooting with a lot of preconceived idea, and you have to just turn him around. Like, for instance, he wanted to do 48 takes, and I knew that after the second takes, it would be not as good, and it was great the two first takes when he didn't know what was going on, really, and he was just lost and trying to find his mark. And as soon as he would find his mark, the shtick would come. And like right. The two first takes were amazing, because he knew his text. He was very eager to do well, so he learned his line very well, which is very appreciable, and that... Mm. That's great for an actor that knows his lines, and it's not so often that they do so. So that was great. And Kate really pushed him and went over the top. So, for instance, when I would communicate my direction, I would talk to them separately, because I would take to Ken, go ahead, make it over the top, and I would take to Jim, this is not a comedy, make it very minimal. And if he had heard me talking to Kate, this way he would have exploded. And right. But for instance, there is this moment when she hits him in the shoulder with her fist in a train. I told her, okay, this time you're going to punch him as hard as you can. And there is this thing when see you later, and she punched him in the shoulder, and he looks at her with such like a look that he was like, fuck you, Kate Winslet. he didn't say anything, but the look was so real. And it's how I get that. And like sometime as well, when he was trying to, I had this idea when he saw the elephant, he would become an elephant with his jacket and play with the sleeve to make the trunk. And when he was doing it, I said to Ken, okay, leave the frame now, disappear. And he does it, and then he looked for her reaction, and she was gone. And he was looking for Kate Winslet, not for Clementine at this time. And he has this lost look in his face that's really touching, because he has, like a child who's hiding and nobody's looking for him. So, I knew, I find him how to trick. I mean, it's not only tricking, but I think actors are a little bit like children.
Well, what did you feel like you were bringing, like your most important job as director? You have this amazing script, like, Charlie Kaufman, and then these great actors. And there's an incredible lightness of touch that you bring to this. I don't know. But
well, I think my task was first, it was a lot about how we would go into the memory, go from one memory to the other, from reality to the flashbacks, etc. A lot of transition. And as well, how the memory would decay because they were erasing them. There was something repetitive a little bit, because it's like a... the same process that occurs every time, the memory disappears. So we're trying to find original way without being showing off, but to entertain the audience for every transition, every transformation or disappearance. And Charlie had written stuff that were great. Like, remember, he was talking about the husks of the insect, you know, when they change skin, and the memory was supposed to be like that at some point. And it was undoable for me unless I would have tons of money and CGI or whatever. So what I think he wrote it with poetry, his screenplay, and I had to find a corresponding way to put that visually without transcribing every word, because it was not the same language. Yeah. So to me, it would be like, for instance, memories of some sort of texture, like the corrugated fiberglass that you have to protect from the rain in the garden when you're a kid. I had that to protect my bicycle. And this sort of very textured memory, I try to mix them in a sort of an appropriate way. Like suddenly the top of the table is replaced by that. Also, it's raining inside of the room. just like misplacing scenes at, instead of having special effect doing it. So I thought of many ways to bring this element of alteration of the moment. Like I remember we had this big frame and we put this transparent plastic or visqueen, which is just something you use to protect of the rain, but that diffused the image in a very artistic way. And we had the frame that were carried by gags behind Jim Carrey, and we would shoot obviously without seeing the frame, but you would just see all the background blurry. It's something that would look very common if you do it in post-production, but because we actually went into the trouble to do it physically, I think it makes it different. Like for instance, we had this scene in Barnes and Noble, and we started the scene in a Chinese restaurant, and then we continued the Barnes and Noble. So we made the Chinese restaurant, at least the corner, in the Barnes and Noble, because in my brain it was very satisfactory to think of dressing a restaurant within the library, the bookstore. I mean, this type of things.
Yeah.
That sounds technical, but I think through this process I managed to illustrate what Charlie had written in the world.
For your next film, The Science of Sleep, this is your first screenplay that you originated. So this film, a film is part of this in the same building in Paris where an ex-girlfriend...
But it's already, in this case, in this instance, it was a mother of my son. I think she deserves a different title.
Okay. Well, what are you... Okay.
Well, she's an ex-girlfriend, but she's the mother of my son, so okay. It's more... I don't know.
Well, okay.
You get attached for life, no matter what happens, because you have this child. we lived there with her and my son in the same building, two floors below, so it was the same apartment.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about how the script came about and how,
It started when I did the video for the Foo Fighters, and each one was having their own dream, and they would interact. They could go through each other's dream. And I started to see the possibilities of that. And initially, it was much more about Stéphane, and Stéphanie was just more like a muse or not really existing in the real world. I met this person who we worked together, and I had the same situation that's going on in the film. So this sort of creative connection and non-reciprocal attraction, this very difficult situation that's pretty common, unfortunately. So I gave much more substance to the character of Stéphanie through this person I knew. And so it becomes much more about creativity, about these moments that when you feel you're so close, and then that should stay forever, but it doesn't work like that in real life.
Yeah, it's great how you just feel throughout the whole film that they are meant to be together. They seem to be kindred spirits, but they just don't quite connect. Okay, so you're invited because I guess maybe you made a film with the title with science in the title. You're invited to MIT. But tell us what you were doing there.
They invite artists.
Okay.
I like mathematics and geometry, and I responded immediately when they reached out to me. But to me, it was great to go there. I mean, that's a great thing about doing my job, is like I go to universities and I sort of fulfill a lack in my education in some ways, because I didn't go so much in school and I felt I could have tried harder. And then now I go back to school and I have this sort of nice energy from being at school, and I learn to express a little bit more of myself or my feelings or whatever. So I do a good use of my time by going into school now. And going to MIT was great because, of course, they come up with great stuff there. I went 1 week, 1 year, and the next year another week. Mm-hmm. And it was great because I met all those guys that were working and mixing with computer and technology. And It's just like sort of brainstorm, basically, and I get a lot of ideas, and I met amazing people. The last time I went there, I had the luck to meet and talk with Noam Chomsky, which I had read and watched a lot of documentary on, and so it was, you have this space where all those brains are communicating, so it's great to be part of that for a little bit.
And I read that you were doing experiments there where you were trying to combine computers and digital technology with chemical reactions, trying to get
chemical. Well, we worked on this thing that's called cornstarch. You know, you mix this corn powder with water, and it's, I forgot the name of this type of texture. It's solid when you heat it hard, and it's soft when you go slow. So you have, they have this game in Japan when you can run on it, but if you run too slow, you just dive. Mm. And if you take just a little scoop and you put a speaker underneath with precise frequencies, and you film it with a strobe light, you have this crazy shape that looks like alien. And it's just amazing when you find the right, it starts by the geometrical pattern and then start to raise. And I just, the second week I went, we did a sort of workshop where everybody would bring their idea, and my idea was like, okay, all the special effects now are completely done by computer, and I think something is missing from the chemistry or the physical world, and I was trying to find ways to combine, to use the digital technology to control the duration and the repetitivity of the effect, and use the analogic or the chemistry or the physical element to create the complexity of the effect, because there is so many parameters when you mix, let's say you mix two products and they're going to interwave. It's something that you can never reproduce with a computer. So if you can mix both, I think you can achieve something really, really strong.
The film after this is a real sort of change of pace. It's in a way, very spontaneous. It's Dave Chappelle's Block Party. It's your first feature documentary.
Yeah.
And it sort of has the spirit of, you know, Dave Chappelle decides to put on a show in a block in Brooklyn, like sort of throw a concert. So it's the same kind of do-it-yourself, this idea of just sort of taking an idea and like making it actually happen. It's this great combination of a performance by Kanye West and this marching band, I guess, that he found in Ohio.
The production that hired me, I mean, that produced this show, they didn't really care of what was outside the concert. But I didn't want to just shoot a concert. So we find this idea with Dave that he would go into places and try to sell tickets or give tickets for his concert. And he went into his hometown in Ohio, and he was stopping people in the street, and we shot all of that. And it was funny because it was quite hard, actually, to find people that would commit to go to Brooklyn.
Well, he shows up in Ohio and says he's sort of giving out tickets to this concert he's throwing in Brooklyn in 3 days.
Yeah.
Right?
And but he's asking the most unexpected people, and some people who just don't like rap music, or someday this lady, she's going to Canada for a trip. But so it's funny because, of course, I started to do movie very precisely, and Human Nature was very, I would not say contrived, but it was very prepared. And I realized I was missing a little bit some life there. And when I went to do Eternal Sunshine, I made sure I was not so ready the day of the shooting. I was ready in terms of what I wanted to achieve with the scene. Even not sure of that, but like especially for the camera position, the framing, I would really give much more space to the actor. And then when I did the Block Party, then I went on the set on a street with nothing, and that's really totally scary. But that was the challenge. It's like you go with nothing in mind, and then nothing happened, and then you get this tension of like, okay, I'm going to go back home tonight, and I will have nothing. Like, because like it's noon and there is nobody in the street, so they let's go to this pizza parlor, and then it's nothing happening there. And then we go, let's go into this store, bookstore. I know those guys are great, and then it's dead there. And then they go to a barber, and it's like very, very little happened. And I say, okay, well, I know those guys there; they're great. So we go by this high school, and then there is, and it's the end of the day, and this is kids who are running late for their rehearsal in a marching band, And I said to Dave, okay, go talk to them, because of course they're going to recognize him. And then suddenly something happened. They all group around him, and they want to show him that they know this Kanye West song. So they start to play the song, and he play with them. And then later on, he invites them to come to the concert, which most of them never went to New York. And so we have to organize the trip, and they have to get authorization from the head of the school. Right. And then they have to negotiate with him, and you see the guy talking. He's going to say yes, he's going to say no, and finally he says yes to the conductor, and the conductor say, yeah, you're going to New York, and everybody explodes in joy. And I think what's great is like, you build up this tension by wasting film. We were shooting on film. And I think that's a good thing. Like, but it was on tape, you would just roll and roll and roll. But on film, you're like making crucial, like excruciating decisions. Like, okay, let's roll 10 more minutes on that, and nothing happened. And then you add up nothing to nothing. And then you feel you're going to really wasting your day on the day for people on the budget. But then there is one little thing that happened, and it's just wonderful. And I think that's it's something I learned a little bit from Raymond Depardon, who's a French filmmaker,
yeah.
Who does amazing documentaries. And he has this rule he applies to himself, is when he shot, he used to shoot in film, I don't know how he shoot now, but the mag are 10 minutes long. And he has this rule, when he starts a mag, he's not allowed to stop the camera. And so he creates this tension when he said to himself, oh, it's nothing happening. Or he did this amazing one when he follow a police precinct through their week. And so he started the camera, and she's wasting film away. And he said that this tension that he's creating makes such a suspense. Then you get the slightest little event, and it's just amazing. And he gets amazing things. He visits a place where the guy called the police because he finds his wife dead, and he doesn't know she's dead yet. And they come and they say, "This is the décédé. Charlie, Dingo, Charlie." They have a code that means deceased. But they don't want to say it out loud for the guy to not collapse, because they have to manage how they're going to break the news.
Yeah.
And they arrive and you see their face, and they're telling the wife is dead. And then he just stops the camera because he's very decent. And then you see the guy, he just learned that his wife is dead, and he's like thinking, oh, what are we going to do with the body? So he's so in the moment completely lost that he's just grabbing the most trivial question. You have to be so unprepared, and it's so prepared over the years, but completely unprepared in the moment to achieve that. And all these documentaries are a compilation of these moments that are amazing. So, of course, I will not compare myself to him. That was my first really documentary. But I had that in mind, that going out with nothing prepared and just waiting for the thing to happen. And then you have wonderful things that happen, and they are magical. There is this moment when the Fugees reformed, that didn't play together in 7 years or 6 years, and they are waiting to go on stage, and you see Lauryn Hill waiting on the side. And I mean, this moment gives me a goosebump when I watch it, because it's really, and the music is just amazing. So that was great. That was a complete different experience.
And did some of that carry over into Be Kind Rewind, because you used real people from Passaic, New Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, I was asked by Dave Chappelle to do this documentary concert that was a celebration, but I didn't know what the celebration was for, and I don't think people really knew when I would ask them what it was. So it was basically African-American musician, rapper with a political conscience, but Kanye West is a little different. So it was very hard for me to define what I was doing, which was interesting, because I had to find the subject as I was shooting. And I eventually started to understand that they were celebrating a little bit the idea of celebration, the idea of community, which was very, I was sensitive to it, but not so, didn't have much knowledge about it, because I'm coming from a very white, broad neighbor from a suburb from Paris. And there is no sense of community where I came from. It's all about the consumption and the family or whatever. So through Dave Chappelle, well, all his humor is based on race and confrontation, differences. So I started to look into that and basically initially I wanted Dave to do Be Kind with me. And so I felt, okay, I will be fine to talk about racial issues and even make some jokes about it when he was with me, because that's what he does all the time. And right. He's fine, he's black, so I would be alone. But then he went, and I was on my own, so I decided, okay, I'm going to still do it. So I felt very awkward, but I had learned a lot from that. I mean, this idea of shooting with people who are not necessarily used to the camera, or the idea to represent a group of people and talk about more than two people, which was the case in my previous movies. It was always about two or four people or even one person. And then it was a bigger group of person.
And you came up with this great idea of a video store where all the movies are erased accidentally. And so the video clerks, Jack Black and Mos Def, decide they're going to reenact every movie. And so they'll make their own Ghostbusters and Rush Hour. And you came up with this term, sweeting, which is, that's the process of sort of
remaking,
doing a do-it-yourself version of a Hollywood film. So when you were filming the sweeted movies, what was the process like of making those? Was that just all sort of improvised?
Oh, no, it was prepared because all the tricks have to be ready and it has to be safe, so you can just you can't improvise that. Some of the dialogue were improvised, and sometimes we had extended shot when they were really having fun and being silly. But the problem I had, it was hard for me to convey to them to not overact the bad acting. And it's a little bit embarrassing to say to an actor. But basically, I had to say, you don't have to act badly. If you act good, it's going to be bad enough. And it's true. And I have seen that in so many movies when actors pretend they are not actors. They think they are so good as an actor that if they were not an actor, they would be terrible. And the fact is, that it's not so much of a difference. And I'm saying that because I expect there's not too many actors in a room, so excuse, I will not dare to say that to their friend. No, I tell them, try to do it as good as you can. I find it a little condescending from the actor world, that when they act like if they're not actor, they would act terribly. And I've seen that in many movies. It's like somebody who acts as it doesn't. It's very hard to ask somebody who sing in tune to sing out of tune. So they would generally overdo it, and it makes no sense, because if I try to sing in tune, I would be out of tune, but it's not going to be completely absurd. And the same thing when I ask people to make the props and make them handmade. In the beginning, they were like painting like totally in a rubbish way, and I told them, okay, those guys are not like the best artists, but they can paint something white without having a big patch of cardboard apparent. So it's just, they were overdoing they were overacting the painting.
So you took this idea to the next level by taking the sets of Be Kind, Rewind and doing an installation at the Deitch Gallery, the Jeffrey Deitch Gallery, and you invited people to come in and use the costumes and sets and make their own movies. And
This was my initial idea for Be Kind, Rewind. So the concept I had for very long time, and I want to insist a little bit on that, because I know there is other movies, and it's always the case when you do something, like when we did the Eternal Sunshine, Memento just came out before, there is always people who think, oh, you know, he's just trying to do what's in the mood of the time. And there were those kids who did the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and there was Son of Rambo, and etc. And all that, those are great things, and there is YouTube. My concept came personally very early. When I move in Paris, I find I move into a district which has so many theaters that were transformed into other business, because all the small theater collapsed in the 70s when the big multiplex emerged. And you have all the cinema were abandoned or transformed to Schuster or whatever. And I wanted to take one, use it to sort of create a community around the theater and give a camera to the neighbor and ask them to shoot whatever they want. And then we would edit it in a fast way and screen whatever they had shot during the weekend. I would pay the price of a regular ticket. And then the next week, we're going to use this money to reshoot. And then every week, you would have the movie of the neighbor. And it would be probably terrible, but it would be great because they are in it, so they see themselves. And I wanted to do it for real, but I didn't really pursue. As being a director, that's one of the things you can do. You can create something that you, a utopia, for instance, that doesn't seem to be possible in the real world, but you construct the world around your idea, and then you make the idea work. So that's what I did.
It's a little bit like what the Kuchar brothers were doing in the Bronx, going to see big Hollywood movies and then sort of making their own versions, low-budget versions. What surprised you most about the types of movies that people made during this?
Bad question, because they are very different. What surprised me is it's hard, I'm not going to answer your question directly. I don't like to do that. Let me think what was the main surprise. Is the goal was not the film themselves, is to see the process of people going through this protocol I was talking about earlier. Shoot, basically people would walk in, and there is all sorts, lot of rules to follow, and you had all the set at your convenience, and you have two workshops. One workshop you have to start with the genre, the title, and then you would go to the storyline, and then a more detailed storyline, and then you would go to workshop two, and you would have this big grid you would fill up. The principle basically was like each storyline becomes a scene. So if you make a storyline that basically makes sense, and if you can illustrate each sentence of the storyline, then you make a movie that makes sense. You can tell the story. So that was the idea. And then when you had your grid, that would include basically the action, not the dialogue, but the accessories required, the location. Then you would have a camera and edit in the camera. And for 1 hour, you would shoot. And then you would go into the video store from Big Camera One that we reproduced and watch a movie just after having shot it. And every time it was the same reaction because of the fact that you're in the film, because you see all what's in between the text, all the mistakes, or sometimes in the case of our film, we did The Last Day, we have the biggest group, we are 20, and Tim Robbins, even Susan Sarandon came, and it was really fun because they really were playing with us. For instance, the cameraman forgot to switch off the camera for 2 minutes, and we would hear all our conversation, how we're going to set the next scene, and he came up with a line, I'm a hitman, so what, you have a problem with that? And so it was, all the mistakes are something that you appreciate because you remember doing them. And this is this connection to making your film and watching it, I was trying to explore. And this was really successful because every time you would see people watching their work or their game, they would have the same excitement. And maybe what surprised me the most is I got the same result in terms of interest or creativity from people who were from the film world or to people who had nothing to do with the film world, which... It's a little bit the point I was trying to make. I feel we're a little club of people making movies, and we're I was meeting somebody this morning, and he said, oh, I met this person in this place, and then I realized he worked with you. This is such a small world. And I said to this person, yeah, it's a small world because we don't want to share it. Meaning that we are all lucky in this world to be creative, but we kind of do everything we can to not have too many people know that they could do it. Because then we won't do it so much and make so much money off it. And my opinion is, if you give a camera to a lot of people, they would do a better job than me, but I'm not told that, and I'm telling them a little bit by doing this type of things, but overall, they're not told that.
I don't think they do a better job, but...
No, okay, well, I'm fishing for a compliment, maybe. It's true, but the thing is, I think there is a privilege here that's not being shared a lot.
Well, I do. Before we end, I want to congratulate you on winning a Webby Award, I guess, both for, I think, the spirit of Be Kind, Rewind, and what it's saying about this kind of do-it-yourself generation. I think that's one reason you won, and also these two YouTube videos where you solve Rubik's Cubes with your feet and your nose, which has been seen by 4 million people. So congratulations on that award, and we look forward to all your future work. And thanks
a lot
for being here.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.